On the Empire Podcast this week, we go country but not western with the Wild Rose herself, Jessie Buckley.
I don't think anybody's going to understand us by the end of this.
Sorry, what was that?
Sorry, what did you say? Yeah, or as they say in Ireland, huh?
All that and more on the movie podcast that has had its world rocked this week by two things. One, the revelation that Joe Russo, co-director of Avengers Endgame, is a Liverpool fan. And two, those pictures of Jude Law on the beach. I mean, blimey.
Wow.
Hello, pod. I'm Chris Hewitt, and welcome to the Empire Podcast. This week, I'm joined by two colleagues, two colleagues of such lethal cunning. We are, of course, joined by our geek queen, Helen O'Hara.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm fine. I mean, I'm not sure how I'm supposed to feel about the Pope now after those Jude Law pictures.
Yep.
He was, of course, filming the young Pope in tidy whities and,
yep,
you know, a whole lot
it's not
of personal
the new Pope,
training.
I believe.
The new Pope,
the
I
new
apologize,
Pope.
Yep. Yes.
Or the nude Pope, as some wag said on Twitter. Anyway, let's fill people in. Let's introduce Ben Travis first.
Yes, hi, Ben.
Hello.
Hi, Ben. You all right, Ben?
Yeah, I'm good. I'm good. Also, spending a lot of time thinking about the pilf, as I feel like the internet is about to dub him.
Fat I can.
No.
Fat I can.
No, no.
Anyway, yes. Hello, Ben.
Hello.
So let's put these pictures in context, mm-hmm, and then we'll talk about the important thing, which is Joe Russo supports Liverpool. So Jude Law, he's on the beach,
yes,
earning 20%, and there he is with nips out and everything.
He's been working out, obviously. He's a healthy, clean living man. He's taking good care of himself, and he's scantily clad, frankly. But he's also in defence of, not being sexist. There are scantily clad women all around him throwing beach balls, no
less. Were there? I hadn't noticed. Genuinely, I hadn't
noticed. Really?
So, were there? Okay, that's cool.
Yeah, there were.
That's cool.
Yeah.
Well done.
Do you reckon those tighty whities, are they sort of like papally? Are they official papal wear? Obviously, you have the gowns and the pointy hat. Are there trunks for those eventualities?
Mm-hmm. I mean, maybe some priests can write in and not tell us. That would be super good. If
that
they
would
could
be
just
an ecumenical matter.
Definitely not let us know. That would be super.
So that caused quite the stir, quite the old kerfuffle. And it's the best advertisement, frankly, for that show that I've seen so far. So there you go. Tune in to the new Pope whenever it hits a screen near you at some point to see what the hell is going on in that shot. What's he doing? It's a dream sequence? What's happening?
I mean, it could be a dream sequence, or it's a very odd show anyway, so it could be reality, let's be honest.
Okie dokie. But the second thing that rocked my world this week is the revelation that Joe Russo, co-director of Avengers Endgame, does indeed support Liverpool Football Club, who, I don't know if you're aware of this,
I think everyone is, Chris,
is also my team.
Yes, I think everyone knows that. I think people who have never met you know that.
I think this, I was on the fence vis-a-vis Avengers Endgame.
Mm-hmm.
This has put me over the top, I think.
So you now think it might be a good film?
It might be good. It's got a shot.
As people listen to this, it's less than 2 weeks away.
That's extremely exciting. In fact, as we record this, it's 2 weeks today.
I know.
As we record this, it's 2 weeks today until Avengers Endgame opens in the UK. 15 days until you get it in the States. Ha ha ha, suck it, Americans. It is also, shall we say, less than 14 days until some of us see the film.
Squeak. It's fine. We're keeping it together. We're totally fine.
It's cool.
Yes.
It's cool.
We're absolutely 103% professional. Very, very exciting. And in fact, this is my last stint hosting the podcast. I'm not going to do one of those things where I go, oh, I'm not hosting the podcast, then I turn up and you're hosting the podcast and then I'm in the corner.
I think you need to say until at some point in the sentence, otherwise people are going to freak out. This is not your last podcast.
Oh, well, no.
Until?
No, but what a way to go out with Joe Russo supporting Liverpool and Jude Law getting his nips out on the beach. I mean, that's like, I've had dreams like that. Anyway, this is my last podcast until
there we go.
Avengers Endgame comes out, because I'm going to LA for the next 11 days as of this weekend. So, Helen, you're going to be holding the fort.
Yes.
So, I had said to people on the Twitter machines that they should ask us questions. And because it's the last time I'll be on the podcast before Endgame comes out,
sure,
it's our last chance to tackle Endgame related questions and theories and whatnot.
Speculation. So, wild speculation. And uninformed wild speculation.
Yes, indeed. So here we go. I've got loads and loads of questions. And we're going to race through them as quickly as we can.
Okay.
All right. Let's give it a go. Usually we just do one question. But today we're throwing caution to the wind. @Phil_Ferg asks, do you think Adam from Guardians of the Galaxy 2 will appear in Endgame?
Adam Warlock, this would be.
Adam Warlock.
Who's teased in one of the post-credit stings to Guardians 2. I think no. I think they're going to save him for Guardians 3. You're welcome.
I mean, I entirely agree with Helen. I don't know what I have to add there. I think as well, there's already so many characters and so many things going on. I feel like it doesn't need Adam Warlock. That can wait.
Yeah. Yes. This now is not the time to introduce a major new character.
But the reason, of course, why people might think that he would be involved is because he has previous with the Infinity Stones and with Thanos and all that sort of stuff.
I mean, like Squirrel Girl has defeated Thanos in the past, and nobody's talking about her turning up, are they? So I'm just saying.
That's fair. Okay, here's a good one from the Chocolate Patriot at Moans Mats. And Leigh ask, because I don't know Moans Mats, I guess it's Matt, but Leigh ask, what would you say is the most important film in the Infinity Saga? I was rewatching Age of Ultron, and I do feel it's a strong contender. One of the weakest films, but confirms Infinity Stones as key to future films and leads to Sokovia Accords.
So in terms of setting up a lot of pieces...
Yeah, because a lot of people have been asking this recently, what films you should rewatch in the run-up to Avengers Endgame.
Sure.
Now, I don't know if you've been following my film recommendation thread on Twitter. Chris Hewitt's Film of the Day, 2019. Do follow, or more likely mute that hashtag, to see what film I recommend every day.
It's the same film every day, Chris. It's always Infinity War.
Yeah, this is true. This is very, very true. But
so that's one of the ones.
That's
that
one of the ones you should watch.
Rewatch.
Yes, watch Avengers: Infinity War. But yeah, Age of Ultron, all the Avengers movies.
I think all the Avengers movies. That makes sense. I think Civil War is going to play into the immense amount of semi-suppressed emotion that I'm hoping for between Cap and Tony, and
First Guardians. Not only because it introduces the Guardians, but that is the first film as well where it really starts to delve into what the stones are, and you have Thanos turning up for like a few scenes in that as well, so that feels like a pretty pivotal
before they really focused on and decided on what he looks like.
It's a step forward from the Avengers non-assemble post-credit sting, but yeah, they hadn't quite figured out that design yet, had they?
No, they hadn't. Maybe they'll get it right one day. Any more in terms of the important films in the MCU? I would say probably you should start with Iron Man.
Okay.
Then move
controversial,
on
right?
to The Incredible Hulk. I know a lot of people diss The Incredible Hulk, but I think it's important in reminding people who General Thunderbolt Ross is and, of course, who Bruce Banner is.
Fantastic. And then I would say Iron Man 2. Now, I
That's
know,
bold
again,
and controversial, Helen.
It is, but it does establish a lot of detail about S.H.I.E.L.D. and Nick Fury and everything else, which might be relevant.
And Coulson. You can't watch Avengers without knowing who Coulson is, and Coulson's in those first couple of films.
Exactly.
All right, so after that, I would probably go, top of my head, Thor.
Okay.
Thor.
And then
yeah.
I've got to get a mention in for my favourite, Captain America, the First Avenger.
Captain America, the First Avenger.
But then you need the First Avengers when they all assemble.
It just makes sense.
It does.
So
it
you probably sense. Follow Cap with Avengers.
You would probably follow Cap with Avengers.
But then it's been a really long time since you watched any Iron Man, so...
You need some Tony.
You need some Iron Man 3.
You're jonesing for Tony.
And you need to see how he was affected by the events of Avengers.
Yeah.
So I guess, yeah.
I would absolutely so. Iron Man 3, the best Iron Man film. That is correct, Ben. Well done. After that, I would probably go.
Hang on.
Oh yeah,
Captain America: The Winter Soldier.
I was going to say Guardians of the Galaxy, but you want to go back to
Captain America: The Winter Soldier, and then Guardians of the Galaxy.
Guardians of the Galaxy, because you know what? It's got a great soundtrack.
It really does.
And at this point, you probably need to start tapping your toes a little bit. Okay.
And Winter Soldier, because it's the best one.
Oh yeah, and they're both integral to the plot. Stuff.
I feel like people may see what we're doing here.
All right, we'll have to speed it up. All right, after that, then you got to do Avengers: Age of Ultron, because that's very, very important.
Sure, as the questioner so rightly says.
Yeah, and it's epic, so you need an amuse-bouche, a palate cleanser, so that's Ant-Man. So after that, I'll go for Ant-Man. Mm. Then after that, I would go for Captain America: Civil War, epic.
Need more Cap at that point, yeah.
Yeah, need more Hawkeye.
Got
and
it.
There's loads of Hawkeye in there, and he's in it for like 3 minutes and 47 seconds, something like that. So you got Captain America: Civil War. Then after that, go for Doctor Strange, and this kind of like weird and eccentric and psychedelic and what the hell is going on?
Sure.
So you need that in your life, don't you?
You definitely do.
And then you need Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2.
Yeah.
And then you need
Thor Ragnarok, right?
No, Spider-Man Homecoming.
Spider-Man Homecoming, you're right.
That's what you need. Then you need Thor Ragnarok.
Yeah.
That's important. It is important because it leads directly into Avengers and Infinity Game and End War. And all this sort of stuff. Then I'd go Black Panther.
Okay.
Avengers Infinity War.
Yeah.
Chris Hewitt's Film of the Day, 2019. Yeah. And then I would go Ant-Man and the Wasp. I know much maligned in this room, but it's an Elmore Leonardian blast. and then I would go...
Hang on, Captain Marvel.
Captain Marvel. Sisters are doing it for themselves. And I'd finish off with Avengers Endgame. That's what I would do.
That's a bold strategy. Let's see if it pays off.
Are the 21 films I think you should catch up with before you see Avengers Endgame? All right, just a couple more questions. Peter Turner asks, what in the world could Marvel ever do in the future that could be more of a massive event than Endgame? And I'd like to see a Logan-style 18-rated Iron Man movie where he gets really sweary and violent. No. Just no.
As we're going to talk about a bit later in the podcast, I think going sweary and violent for its own sake is not necessarily always a winning strategy.
Fuck no.
I mean, in terms of what Marvel can do next to outdo Endgame, I think whatever that's going to be, it's going to be so many years down the line that the reason Endgame is such a big deal is because it's paying off on such a long kind of amount of storytelling. So yeah. I think we can't even picture what that's going to be yet because we need to be invested in Doctor Strange and Black Panther and Captain Marvel to the same extent as we are to the OG Avengers this time.
I mean, assuming that they even survive, you know, we don't know. Right now, as Chadwick Boseman keeps telling people, he's dead.
I'm dead.
Super dead.
A few people have said, what will we do if Endgame sucks?
You know what? We made it through this far. We can cope. It'll be painful and difficult. Is it bad that I really don't think it will? I genuinely feel like that team have our trust for a reason. So,
I mean, if you looked into sort of 14 million possible futures, I can't imagine that many of them where Endgame ends up being disappointing.
I can imagine a few.
I mean, you within know, 14 million, like yeah, two.
Because you got to imagine there's one where it's directed by like a singing dog or something.
Or McGee.
Or McGee. Because the singing dog was unavailable.
Second choice.
Yeah.
Hey, McGee was an original producer on Supernatural. Thank you very much.
Okay. All right. At A underscore Albazuras asks, if a genie told you you could put an end to Brexit, but in exchange, you could never watch Endgame, would you do it? Ooh. I can't believe you've actually taken this long to think about it. Yes, I would end Brexit.
I mean, yes, I would. I would.
Come on.
I'm just like, are people allowed to like explain Endgame to me? Like, talk me through it? Are they allowed to tell me what happened? Can I read the Wikipedia spoiler page?
I don't know. It's the will of the people, Helen. Whatever they say. We put it to the vote.
Oh, God.
52% of the people say no. Then you're shit out of luck. And then finally, Christine Rogers, whose Twitter handle is at WritingFreak88, asks, at what point does Steve die? 1 hour in, 2 hours in, 2 hours and 45 minutes in, discuss.
I refuse to engage with this. I refuse to sanction this buffoonery. That's what I do.
I think it is going to be a sort of Groundhog Day style movie where the poor fella dies 25 times. And each time in a slightly more pathetic way. Like one, he does a charity thing to raise money for survivors of the snap, and he gets into a bathtub full of baked beans. He bangs his head and he drowns slowly in a bathtub full of baked beans.
Okay, I know you're joking, but I'm genuinely prepared for that because I've watched a Supernatural episode called The Mystery Spot.
Oh God, there's always a Supernatural
episode. There is always a Supernatural
episode. There's
always
a Donald Trump tweet, yeah. And there's always a Supernatural episode.
Genuinely, Dean Winchester dies about 100 times in it. So I have been through that. Worst case scenario.
Okay.
I'm serene. I can cope.
All right.
And Steve is going to live forever.
I like your thinking. And of course, The Outsider is the explosion in a dildo factory that I thought would do for Nick Fury's eye in Captain Marvel. It didn't. That's still on the table. That is still on the table,
and
folks.
And it's always going to stay on the table, far away from the screen.
You have to ask yourself what sort of screenwriting hoops you would have to go through in order to get Steve Rogers into a dildo factory, but I'm sure it would be germane to the plot.
To be honest, if Bucky was in there, he would do anything for Bucky.
Yeah.
If he had to.
What's Bucky doing in a dildo factory?
You ask him. He would have some kind of answer for you. He would claim that he had been brainwashed and that someone had said a series of random words to him and he'd ended up there.
Anyway, that's it for the Avengers Endgame theories and question marathon. And then, I won't be answering any more questions for anyone for two more weeks. If you want to have your question read out in the Emperor podcast and treat it with the respect it or they deserve, you can get in touch with us via a number of methods. We're on Twitter, of course, as at Emperor Magazine. Use the hashtag Emperor Podcast, or chances are Helen won't see them over the next couple of weeks.
That's right.
We're also on Facebook as Empire Magazine. Facebook us. No one ever sends in questions to Facebook. We never check.
We
literally never check. And you can email us as well. I do check that every single day. Podcast at empireonline.com. Right, should we get into some movie news?
Yes, let's.
Some lovely, lovely movie news.
Can we talk about the Grease thing? Grease is apparently getting a prequel called Summer Loving. or at least John August, the screenwriter, is working on a script for such a film, which would explain the first connection between Danny and Sandy on their summer holidays.
Tell me more.
Oh, God, why did we set him up for that? Oh,
I'm
God.
I'm so sorry. There was nothing I could do. That's all there is, really, I'll be honest. And
tell me more. What the hell's taken them so long?
I mean, that's not really the question that springs to mind. My question my question is simpler. My question is why? My question is, what does this really give us that we need in the world? And I think it's genuinely worth asking, because Grease worked, right? Because, okay, it's got catchy songs and stuff, but it was made in the 70s and it was set in the 50s. And it had that kind of nostalgic kick for people who vaguely remembered that time.
Yeah.
And then it also had, it was a little bit boundary pushing compared to how the 50s were, you know, in terms of talking about condoms and talking about, you know, teen pregnancy and things like that, which people might not have had in teen movies 20 years before. So it kind of offered something as well as just the catchy songs. I'm not clear on what it offers us now, because I feel like today's teenagers are so divorced from the teenagers of the 1950s. They're so much cooler and so much more interesting and so much less hidebound by these very, very strict gender roles that the Pink Ladies and the T-Birds have, that I don't see what there is for any young person to connect to in that film. So it feels to me like they're making this film for people our age and older.
Quite possibly.
And I don't see how it isn't creepy in that case that we're watching these two teenagers mess about on a beach. And also,
you've given this way more thought than I had.
I know, but I can't help thinking how bad an idea it is. And the thing is as well, like, the whole song is a kind of he said, she said.
It tells the tale.
But the tale that they're telling is that the joke of the whole song, the point of the entire thing, is that Danny is making shit up and Sandy is telling the sad but boring truth. Right? So if you mess with that in any way, it doesn't work at all. And it's I just don't see what there is there to work with.
Maybe they'll find that. But maybe John August, who is a screenwriting guru.
I love Big Fish.
I love Big Fish as well.
I'm just saying.
I love huge chips, big fish, massive peas. Oh, you mean the movie Big Fish?
I did, yes.
I have affection for that as well. But he knows what he's doing. And he clearly has an idea for this. I imagine they didn't just go to him. Maybe he pitched this. Who knows? But what I'm saying is, I'm surprised that it's taken them so long, because Grease is wildly popular. And Grease 2, less so.
Grease 2 may be why it is not taken so long.
There are some Santa do's and some Santa don'ts when it comes to making terrible 1980s musicals.
Hey, but I just, on behalf of Cat Brown, formerly of this parish, I have to say, some people love Grease too.
Yeah.
So
absolutely. But, you know, when I heard this news, I thought, you know what? I've got chills.
Are they multiplying?
No, not really.
Well, that's probably just as well.
But there we go. Well, let's move on to the next story. What else is happening? Ben, you look like a man who's got movie news on your mind.
I do. The Lion King dropped a new trailer, which still kind of blagging my head that those are not real animals. This is probably the most photoreal. Like, is this... Are we sure this isn't just like a David Attenborough documentary that they're slightly augmenting to make it into a Disney film? Because some of those shots... Like, I even believe that Timon and Pumbaa are skipping through the jungle together and singing Hakuna Matata.
But doesn't that make it weird?
Yeah,
it is so photoreal. Weird. Yeah.
It is. But do you know what? I have to say, the Jon Favreau Jungle Book kind of worked for me. I do love the original, but it had enough of a different tone. It had that sort of almost adventure chase movie kind of thing going on. And I kind of trust Jon Favreau to do something here. I prefer the Disney remakes when they are a little bit more removed from the originals. Yeah. I personally really liked Dumbo because it kind of took those leaps and those swerves. So yeah, hopefully. I mean, it's that mix, isn't it? That all the shots in that trailer are things that you see in the classic Jungle Book. But I don't know, it has a different feel and a different tone. And that voice cast is off the charts.
Crazy good.
Donald Glover, Beyonce, Billy Eichner and Seth Rogen as Timon and Pumbaa, which is genius casting. John Oliver as Zazu.
Chiwetel Ejiofor as Scar.
Who doesn't look as scary as you think he might.
Nor does he sound as scary.
Mm. Yeah.
And this is the thing, that Jeremy Irons is genuinely, as Scar, is one of the great creepy bad guy voices. And Chiwetel Ejiofor is an amazing actor, but I don't know whether he has the voice.
I quite liked his just richness of tone in that voice. Yeah. The bit that really got me though was hearing James Earl Jones as Mufasa. Yes. There's only one Mufasa and he is it, and that was the bit of the trailer that got me. I'm not hugely excited about this otherwise, but I wasn't excited about The Jungle Book and I really enjoyed it. So yeah.
Also, it is going to give us Can You Feel the Love Tonight by Beyoncé featuring Childish Gambino. So I'm in. I'm absolutely in. Speaking of Gambino, by the way, the morning after you listen to this, if you listen to this on Friday, on Saturday morning, Donald Glover is dropping a new film.
That's clumsy.
Called Guava Island. Yeah, hopefully he picks it up at some point. No, it's coming to Amazon Studios or Amazon Prime. It's an Amazon film that's Donald Glover and Rihanna and Letitia Wright. And yeah, it's called Guava Island. He's also headlining Coachella this weekend, so it kind of all ties in. It's from the director of the absolutely incredible This Is America video and loads of episodes of Atlanta, a guy called Hiro Murai. And we kind of know nothing about it at this point, but in the days after you listen to this, it will be available to stream on Amazon Prime, a new Donald Glover film kind of dropping out of the ether.
So, an actual film.
Awesome.
An actual film. And I imagine there will be some kind of music component or an album tie-in, but it's a feature film project.
Good Lord, he makes me feel like an underachiever. I mean, a lot of people do, in fairness, but particularly him.
Yeah, he is like one of the most hyphenated multi-hyphenates, which stick that on his Wikipedia page.
Okay, that's pretty cool. Can I talk about some sad news?
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay.
Some sad news. For me, anyway, that after, I think, 13 years together as a creative partnership, Adam McKay and Will Ferrell are going their separate ways.
Yeah, that is sad, actually. Has there been any reason why given?
I think that old chat, they're just growing apart creatively a little bit, maybe. They made an announcement last week, so they've been working together for years and years and years and years and years. Ferrell, obviously, as one of the stars of SNL at the time he was working on it, and McKay was the head writer at SNL, and they just clicked, absolutely clicked. Then, obviously, they've made tons of movies together, Anchorman, Anchorman 2, Talladega Nights, The Other Guys, Step Brothers, and they've got a production company together as well called Gary Sanchez, which has produced lots of really good comedies and some less good comedies. And they were together, they pioneered Funny or Die, the website as well. But yeah, if you look at the way McKay's career is going, I mean, they're both political guys. They did that George Bush show on Broadway a few years ago where Ferrell played Bush. But McKay's films recently have been The Big Short and Vice, and they've moved away from the humour of Anchorman and Step Brothers and films like that. And Ferrell maybe is still
in that
direction, yeah. So maybe they've just gone, look, okay, I'm over here doing what I'm doing, you're over here doing what you're doing, I'm going to form this company, you're going to form this company, but they've said they're going to remain great friends, and hopefully they'll work together again as director and star down the line.
Yeah, definitely. I love them together.
But yeah, a single tear rolled down my cheek when I heard that news. Oh, very sad.
We should have a fucking Catalina wine mixer in their honour.
It's a fucking Catalina wine mixer.
A fucking Catalina wine mixer.
Absolutely. Have to stick the explicit right in this one this week, won't we?
I have better news that might cheer you up, Chris.
Are they back together again? That was quick.
No, different news, but it might still cheer you. I know how much you adore Hawkeye. And there came the news this week that Disney Plus, the streaming service that Disney is about to launch, will also have a Hawkeye limited series. They're obviously lining up a whole heap of limited series of sort of Avengers spin-offs, and this joins that selection.
Yeah.
Woohoo.
I mean, this is interesting. There's part of me that wishes that they hadn't announced any of this stuff pre-Endgame. Because even if, like, they can't all be prequels, right? I mean, some of them might be prequels. Some of these people, like, there's a Loki series, there's a Scarlet Witch and the Vision series, there's a Falcon and Winter Soldier series, and now there's this Hawkeye series. All those people pretty much are dead as things stand. So Hawkeye isn't. Totally
so
fine.
Three prequels and a sequel.
So, you know, Hawkeye. So they've been so intent on preserving the mystery and keeping the spoilers out of this movie. I mean, the hashtag for Endgame is don't spoil the Endgame. Last year it was Thanos demands your silence. And then they go, I mean, they haven't announced films. They haven't officially announced films, but going, Hawkeye, there's a Hawkeye thing. And then there's some other TV shows with people that you last saw being reduced to their component parts. So I don't know. Hopefully these aren't spoilers. Hopefully it'll all be fine. But
I know.
It's also interesting from a Jeremy Renner standpoint, because I always got the impression that he didn't really enjoy being in the MCU that much. And that's just my observation. Now, you know, I've only interviewed him a couple of times and he was totally fine. I don't know whether you've spoken to him. Maybe you spoke to him in Civil War. I don't know.
No, he was one of the few I didn't get. No, I mean, I think you're right. I think he's been underserved generally by the MCU, with the exception of maybe the Age of Ultron family stuff, which I thought was really nicely handled.
Yes.
But as a character and as an actor, he has so much potential that I'm actually quite intrigued and interested to see what they do with this. And I hope that they actually use a lot of that potential that they never have find time for in the screen, and give it to him here. I'm also genuinely quite happy that they specifically said in this story that it would have a lower budget, obviously, than some of the films. And the reason I'm happy about that is I just want these characters to hang out and talk, which can be done fairly cheaply, you know. So I feel like that would be my ideal Avengers kind of spin-offs. And if it's literally just 8 episodes of Jeremy Renner hanging out as Hawkeye,
yes,
I'm here for it.
I think as well, because he's only ever really appeared in the big team-up movies when there is the biggest crisis in the universe going down that they all have to stop. I think actually a series that maybe focuses on a sense of scale that really works for Hawkeye could give that character a chance to shine in a way that he hasn't always. I mean, they poke fun at it in Age of Ultron, don't they? The kind of, none of this makes sense. I've got a bow and arrow. But
the city is floating.
Yeah, it's poking sense at the truth, which is like, he isn't really doing much compared to everyone else. So I think it would be really good to see that character operating on a different scale for once.
Yeah, absolutely right. If they base it on the brilliant Matt Fraction and David Adger storylines from a few years ago. If you haven't picked up, there's an amazing run of Hawkeye solo comics where he basically buys and becomes the landlord of a building with all the attendant problems and attendant tenants, and it's really, really cool and really funny and offbeat.
And solves those problems with arrows?
Some.
Okay, I'm in for it.
Some.
Here's another suggestion. It's a little bit offbeat, but see what you think. You may remember a few years ago there was something called the Hawkeye Project, which saw a series of sort of fan artists pose Hawkeye in the same kind of over-sexualized poses that the female superheroes often adopted on comic book covers and so on, and in the same kind of skimpy versions of his costume that the female superheroes sometimes wore. Why not 8 hours of the Hawkeye Project in real life?
Are you objectifying men, Helen?
No, but that's the point,
isn't it?
I know,
it's
clever.
I
see,
know. Perhaps he could run down the beach in his tidy whities.
I mean, why not? Apparently everyone's doing it now. So.
I'm doing it after this.
Even the Pope.
Did you guys get my WhatsApp group invite to that?
No.
No,
I did not.
No.
You sure?
That is
check your phones.
You've deleted WhatsApp and thrown my phone in
I'm
the Thames.
I'm going to resend this to you. Just you've got your phones there. I'm just going to double check that the message comes
my
through.
My phone has stopped working.
My phone. I accidentally poured acid to my phone. Oh, my God. Who knew? A couple more things to talk about very, very quickly. Dave Bautista has joined the cast of Zack Snyder's Army of the Dead, which has got me all kinds of excited. Mm. And that's the heist movie set in Las Vegas where a bunch of badass mercenaries break into the walled-off Las Vegas in the midst of this fast zombie apocalypse type thing. And they go, we don't give a shit about this because we're badasses and we're led by Dave Bautista, presumably. So bring it on, zombies.
I bet the zombies bring it on.
Yeah, I bet Dave Bautista brings it on her. Yeah.
Let's hope, for his sake.
Post-Endgame, right now, that movie is the thing that just gives me going, yes, please. Yes, Zack Snyder, zombies, Dave Bautista, yes, please. Anything else? Oh, yes, some more Suicide Squad news. Suicide Squad 2 is now, of course, the Suicide Squad with James Gunn at the helm. And this week it was confirmed that Viola Davis is going to return as Amanda Waller, who's the politician who assembled the team in the first movie and was basically the bad guy of the movie in many, many ways. And Idris Elba is not going to be playing Deadshot. He is going to be in the movie, but he's going to be playing a different character, but they haven't announced who yet. And Jai Courtney will return as Captain Boomerang. So, cautiously optimistic about this movie.
Yeah, I'm just a bit confused about what it is, because it feels like there are so many conflicting reports of it's not really a sequel, it is a total reboot, except for there are going to be returning characters. Mm-hmm. I have no idea whether they're going to find maybe some almost Spider-Verse-y way of explaining how these worlds are kind of totally separate, but they have these connecting characters.
I think they've given up.
It'll be a soft reboot. It's sort of semi-sequel, but it's effectively the start of something new.
Yeah. And James Gunn is involved, obviously, as writer-director. That's exciting. Do you think there's a possibility that this movie might suffer just because people will automatically now start assuming this is the movie that he's making before Guardians 3? You know what I mean? And that this movie will suffer almost invidiously in comparison to Guardians 3, because this is the one, once we get this movie out of the way, then he can make the movie that he really wants to make.
To be honest, I think that expectations of a new Suicide Squad were so low that his involvement can still only be...
Singing Dog would direct it.
Yeah, could only be a plus. So I think actually it will get people excited. Okay. Can I mention one final piece of news?
Of course you
very
can,
quickly.
Ellen.
In the Heights, there's news.
In the Heights.
Yes, which is, of course, thank you.
That's how it goes. In the Heights. Do, 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 do.
This is, of course, the Lin-Manuel Miranda musical that he wrote before Hamilton, and actually before Bring It On as well, but that's neither here nor there. It's being filmed by John M. Cho, who obviously has lots of experience with dance movies, which is good. And we now know that Jimmy Smits is going to be on board playing Nina's dad, Kevin, who runs the taxi office that employs Benny, and it's an important role in the middle of the cast, and Jimmy Smits is in it, so hooray!
I didn't know Jimmy Smits could sing.
Even care if he sings. He's great, and I want him in the film.
He's got a really good sad song, that character, as well. He has a very heartbreaking song quite early on, so it'll be interesting to see him in kind of ballady mode.
Yeah.
Can't wait.
Did you see this thing this week where Rachel Segler, who Spielberg has cast to play Maria in his West Side Story, is doing her final school play this week?
That is amazing, isn't it?
Is it the alien school play?
I hope it is. I hope it is.
Have you seen that Kirsten Bell also has a Disney Plus show which is going to try and reunite the casts of school plays?
Kirsten Bell?
Yeah.
Wow.
But like reunite the cast of school plays like 10 or 20 years later and they have to put on their school play again?
Shut the front door.
Right. This sounds hilarious to me and I will 100% be watching it.
Kirsten Bell, if you're listening, and I know you are, I have two suggestions for you. One, reunite the cast of the 1995 Bambridge Academy production of Oliver. The person who played Fagin in that is willing to reprise the role.
Oh my goodness.
I played Oliver in Oliver. Did you?
No way!
Did you play, did you play anyone
in
Oliver?
I was never in Oliver, no, sorry.
But you can do the pipes and the singing.
I feel an Empire production coming on.
I'm reviewing the situation, that's for sure. And recently, my friends and I, we've been getting together, old university chums, and we've been talking about putting on 12 Angry Men, which we did at university. But this time, we're actually almost age-appropriate, as opposed to like just putting grey talcum powder in your hair and you know, pretending to be a bit doddery. And I played Juror Number 4. The E.G. Marshall character in the Sidney Lumet film. So, yeah. Kristen Bell.
Yeah.
Get in touch. As you know, my DMs are open.
I'm sure she'll always be sliding into your DMs anyway.
I can't. Honestly. Oh, it's Bell again. Oh, no. So, yeah. Do that.
We had a primary school production of Cats, and I can only imagine how horrible that was. Cats, already terrible, plus a bunch of, sub-11-year-olds. Who can't sing?
Ellen, do you want to say it or shall I?
Probably better than the film.
Oh, no!
There we go!
Every day is Christmas Eve.
We can't wait to see Cats.
I genuinely can't wait to see Cats. I'm so excited. It'd be like Endgame if I was here for Endgame, which I won't be. But, you know, I'd be queuing up from 3 o'clock.
Yeah.
I'd be just there. Litter tray, everything. The whole kit and caboodle. That is it.
Huffing catnip the whole time. That's going to be amazing.
Oh, it's going to be so terrible. Terribly entertaining.
Terribly good.
So awfully great. I cannot wait to see it. Okay, that is it for movie news. And it is time to tell you that this week's show is once again sponsored by the wonderful people at The Economist. The legendary magazine is over 170 years old. Another 30 years to go and it'll be getting a second telegram from the Queen herself. Who does she get a telegram from if she turns 100?
I think she sends one to herself. She sent one to her mum, didn't she?
Just a stamped self-addressed envelope.
Okay.
So it is to the Queen.
Yay me.
And once again, we have an incredible offer for Empire Podcast listeners, a free print issue of The Economist. This is an incredible offer unlocking a veritable treasure trove of articles about economics, politics, entertainment, and much, much more. I like to gravitate towards the science stuff because the science stuff contains the really freaky, deaky stuff that gets my movie brain working overtime. And one article that caught my eye in the most recent edition, dated April 6th, Fact Fans, tells of how scientists have discovered further evidence of the giant meteor strike that wiped out the dinosaurs, eventually ushered in the era of mankind, and ultimately led to the Empire podcast. So Thank you, asteroid. In the appropriately named Hell Creek formation of Tanis in North Dakota, a group of scientists have unearthed a 1.3 meter thick sedimentary layer that was, says the article, dumped in just one day. And it's loaded with the bodies of fish, and they all face in the same direction. And that indicates they were rapidly buried in a cataclysmic event. And some of the fossils even have evidence of having swallowed fragments of molten glass and quartz generated in the intense heat of the blast. Is this Helen, I know, I can see that this is blowing your mind.
This is, yeah.
And one of the students involved in the discovery, Robert De Palma,
really?
Amazing name. Yes, genuinely. Theorizes that the impact was so immense that it formed standing waves or psyche waves in every large body of water across the planet as tall as 100 meters. As tall as 100 meters. So I looked up what standing waves were, and they're really cool, undulating, kind of really freaky deaky waves that are in bodies of water that are isolated and closed off from everything else. So imagine those, but 100 meters tall and just flipping around a place.
Bodhi would go nuts for it.
And that explains why fish were found in Tanis many hundreds of miles from the big old crater itself in Mexico, and explains why they were affected in such a way. So that blew my mind. It's exciting stuff, and I'm just imagining now a film about the meteor impact, a film with 100 meter tall standing waves. Hollywood, Kristen Bell, get in touch. Just drop me a DM and I will happily write that script for you.
So self-sacrificing.
I'm very selfless in that way. So anyway, if you want to get your hands on a free print copy of The Economist and you want to stimulate your mind grapes with all kinds of the good stuff, it couldn't be simpler. Just text the word MOVIES to the following number, 78070, MOVIES, 78070, and soon you will be enriching and enlarging your brain. Maybe physically. Can we promise that? That you will actually, your brain will become bigger? No.
Chris, as your lawyer, no.
No, we can't do that. But we can say MOVIES, 78070, to get your free print copy of The Economist. And once again, thanks to them for sponsoring the show. Okay, so time now for this week's guest. And Jesse Buckley burst onto the scene as an actor last year, in fact, with the brilliant British movie Beast. But she's been around for a while as a singer and an actor. Came second, in fact, in the BBC's talent competition, I Do Anything.
Does this mean we could get her into our production of Oliver?
Yes, because that sought a new Nancy for a West End production of Oliver. And I'm Fagin, and Ben is Oliver, and you could be Mrs. Sowerbury.
Wait, what?
Well, Nancy's now taken. Oh. I'm afraid there weren't that many great roles for women in that play. Unless, of course, we can switch it up a little bit.
That could
be just Sowerbury. The gaunt, grim, Bill Sykes?
Bill Sykes, I'll take
you. Bill Sykes, the intimidating. Anyway, we'll find a part for you. It's totally fine.
Cheers.
So, Jesse Buckley is in freaking credible in this week's Wild Rose, where she plays a Glaswegian woman who has just been released from prison and wants to fulfill her dream, her destiny of being a country, not country and western, a country singer. And she's tremendous. And Jesse Buckley is Irish, like myself and Helen, but her accent in this is impeccable, as far as I could tell. I've spent 3 days in Glasgow, but it sounded pretty damn good to me. And I was delighted that before she went off to make a film with Charlie Kaufman in New York, that she took time out of her schedule to come into this very studio to sit in that very chair where Ben is right now.
Whoa.
And we had a good old natter. And perhaps we talk about Oliver in this as well. But anyway, here we go. The great Jesse Buckley. Do please enjoy. We're delighted to be joined on the Emperor podcast by the star of Wild Rose herself, Jesse Buckley. How are you?
I'm very good.
Good, good, good. Just talking about being both from the Emerald Isle, so to speak, and just wondering how thick our accents are going to get during this next 20 minutes or so.
I don't think anybody's going to understand us by the end of this.
Sorry, what was that?
Sorry, what did you say?
I'm terribly sorry.
Or as they say in Ireland, huh?
Have you found holding on to your accent easy, difficult? Have you found that English people try and disabuse you of certain notions that you have? For example, whenever I came to England for the first time, I referred to films as films, obviously, because that's what they are.
Yeah.
And then I got told by a rather uppity housemate of mine, excuse me, Chris, I think you'll find the films.
Films.
And now
that is the one word that has changed for me. Uh-huh. And whenever I go back, my Auntie Mary always makes the point, she's like, have you been in the films recently? Yes, Aunt Mary, I have been in the films all the way over in London. But that's the only anglicised word I've taken. I'm actually pretty surprised I've managed to hold on to my accent. And if I go back to Kerry within like an hour, I am completely on I'm not able to be understood.
Subtitles.
Yeah, I have to bring kind of a, you know, interpreter back to London with me.
But accents are you know, obviously they're a huge part of an actor's arsenal. And I saw Wild Rose the other night. I saw it with my wife. And your Glaswegian accent in that is pretty damn tricksy. It's pretty damn tricksy. So after the film, when you came on, you did a performance. Yeah. And you started speaking to the crowd. And my wife turned to me and went, "She's Irish?" There could be no greater compliment.
Yeah. It's funny because I hardly ever use my own accent. Like, I think I've only used it once in a play. And yeah, a lot of people think I'm either very English or very something else. And then they meet me and they're like, "Oh my God, you're very Irish."
I mean, very Irish. Was the accent in Wild Rose tricky? Do you find it easy, you know, easy to come by accents, or is it something you have to work on?
God, I'm deaf. I worked my socks off on it. I think as well because it was like so intrinsic to the character and the sense of identity of Glasgow and that like rhythm and directness and raw energy that Glaswegians have. Like it was just a real kind of thing which helped me navigate where this character was coming from. So I worked on it for months and months and then based myself basically in Glasgow for the month beforehand and irreverently went around to different news agents hoping I'd get away with asking for a pack of fags and that they wouldn't bat an eyelid. And yeah.
So how'd you go?
I got my pack of fags.
You don't even smoke. It's
just, I know. Just, I was just.
You've just got loads of fags now.
Glaswegian fags. Very exclusive.
That's amazing. So after a while, you passed muster. You found that everything was going tickety boo.
Yeah. Well, I think once you start, I don't actually stay in accent when I'm shooting.
Okay.
I thought I might for this, but I it's important for me to come back and be normal so that I can keep relating normally to people.
Okay.
I personally just I know my space where I am when I'm on set and then off it.
Yeah.
That's how I work. I have no idea why.
No, if it works, it works. I remember reading a story once about Robert Carlyle because I think he was very method, may be the wrong word, but he was very committed to staying in accent back in the day. I'm not sure if he would be these days, but he was doing Cracker. He was doing a Scouse accent on Cracker. Yeah. And someone called him up at 3 a.m. and he answered in the Scouse accent. I mean, that's dedication.
That is. It's funny when I'm with like Scottish friends now, like Nicole Taylor, who writes the script, I do find that all of a sudden I kind of put in little Glasgowisms into my chat with her. Like, I'd be like, "Oh, you're, you know, a wee." Wee kind of ends up being injected into my sentences for no reason other than I just want to be Glaswegian for 5 minutes.
That's what acting is, isn't it? You get a chance to take a holiday every day.
Yeah.
Just be someone else, even if you're just for 5 minutes.
Yeah.
But in this movie, I mean, you're acting, for the most part, opposite Julie Walters, who, you know, Christ, is a legend.
Powerhouse.
Yeah. And I don't think there's an accent on this planet that she can't do. But
I don't think there's anything she can't do, to be honest.
I think I'd think that, yeah.
And she's bloody lovely as well. So it's like, come on.
So
she lives on a farm. I want to live on a farm. It sounds excellent.
Oh, you can live on a farm.
I know. I think that's the plan.
That's in your power.
Yeah.
You could do that right now. You could go, you know, live on a farm right now. What was the Julie Walters experience like for you? Apart from the fact that she's so, like, she's just toxic, isn't she?
I never want to see her ever again. she's just, I mean, like, you kind of dream about working with somebody like that, and you hope that they're going to be everything that you dreamed about when you meet them and you get to work with them, and she is just everything and more, and she's so down to earth, she's so committed to all the right things about what this job should be about, and she's doesn't come at it with any ego or with any kind of power trip. She's really just open, and it makes it just so easy to just be in a scene with her because it doesn't feel like you're acting, you know. And we really needed to like have that openness between each other because the relationship is quite it's complex, you know, mother and daughter relationship with all the colors that it exposes. to you as a character and you as a person. And she just was so available and lovely and generous and challenging, and like it made me want to come into work every day and give her everything that I could. More out of fear that I would show her up, and you know, but I feel incredibly lucky to have worked with her. She just is, she's someone you look at and go, I'd like to be like you when I grow up.
Oh, you know, you're not far off, because you know, you are, you know, a bit like Julie is. Julie. Dame Julie.
Yeah.
You know, you are the old multi-threat, as they say, because this movie showcases your singing, and that's something that obviously has been a huge part of your career and life. I mean, have you been looking for something like this, for a film role like this, that would allow you to do both? You know, to do both, or was this just kind of serendipitous in a way?
I don't really look for things.
Just fall into your lap in a way, or
No, not necessarily. Like, it's not something that has just come like that in my life. You know, I've moved over here when I was 17, and I've done everything from selling cereal in Borough Market to doing theatre to doing jazz in dirty clubs around London. Like, it's nothing's been handed to me, and I never ever would expect that to be entitled to be good at this, or to get a script in my lap. But I don't know where, but it comes from. But I have a trust in my belly that stories come to you at certain points in your life, and you kind of meet stories when you're ready to meet them. And I want to be surprised, and I want to be, in a way, with what I look for, I suppose, not necessarily specific things, but I want something that shocks me and distorts my sense of the world and makes me look at the world differently. And with this, you know, I'd worked with Tom Harper before, and I loved working with him, and it's really rare that you get a creative relationship where, you know, you feel like there's a baseline trust there, but also you respect each other and are inspired by each other and push each other. And he could have asked me to lie down on a train track, and I'd have been like, yeah, absolutely no problem, where are we going and what time is the next train? And he brought it to me, and yeah, and that was it. It was kind of,
what did he say?
He said, do you want a pint? And I was like, yeah.
keep talking. This sounds good.
And then, well, he said he had been sent a script. He wasn't going to tell me what it was. He wanted me to read it, but he didn't want to do it if I didn't do it.
Wow.
So that was it.
That's pressure. I mean, like, you've got to read the script.
I'm sure he's lying. It's just kind of mass manipulation, as per, like. But the script was, you know, Nicole Taylor is just an incredible, real writer.
Yes.
And she is so unafraid to go into the, like, core of quite uncomfortable things in people, you know, and qualities that we often in film and in TV and in theatre try to gloss over and sheen, and especially leading female roles. Mm-hmm. There still is like an archetype in film of like making them glamorous or like, and she just is unafraid of that. She wants to get in deeper and darker and release the foibles that make human beings human. Mm-hmm. And that is exactly what's at that, you know, heart of Rosalind. And the script is whatever any of those women are going through, they're coming from a place of their own struggle, which is an incredible gift to be able to you learn a lot about yourself from those things. That's the gift.
What did you learn from this one? How long do you have?
I suppose it's what I learned was that it's hard to want something for yourself. Mm-hmm. And that takes a lot of courage and risk and consequence and falling off the edge of the cliff. But I suppose what I learned, Rosalind had that tenacity and belief, which unnerved me and also brought me along. Even within the music, like, I learned a lot about myself and what I want to keep trying reaching for with the music, you know, and working with those amazing musicians like Neil McCall and Chris Vatilari, or drummer in Ben Nichols, or bass player in Stuart Nesbitt, who's our dobro player, is they're all looking for something truthful in that moment. And we were able to like record all the music live along with the singing on set. So that meant that each moment was truthful and alive, and we were all trying to create an energy which was adding into a scene.
You mentioned earlier that the relationship between Rosalind and her mother is complicated, and Rosalind's complicated.
Yeah.
And she's it's fascinating, you know, just how far this character and how far Nicole and Tom are, and yourself are willing to kind of push the audience's tolerance and sympathy almost in a way. Like the stuff that she does, the stuff she pulls, the stunt she pulls. But at the heart of it all, you get this sense that this is a character that has genuine guilt and genuine feelings as well that drive everything that she does. You can absolutely see everything she does has a reason.
Yeah, yeah. And like at the beginning, it's hard to get on side with her because you're like, what the fuck are you doing? You've got two kids.
Yeah.
You're being completely irresponsible. You're acting selfishly. But I think from what you've said is that like none of those choices come without a cost for her.
Yeah.
And she just has, she hasn't worked out quite yet how to make both those things blend with each other in her life, and she's figuring that out as she goes along. But she's young, you know.
Yeah.
I'm still making doing stuff like that.
Still plenty of mistakes to be made along the way. But we were just talking beforehand, you were saying that Kermode is in your immediate future. And this movie, I don't want to give away too much, but this movie features a cameo from another legendary BBC jockey, Whispering Bob Harris. What was that like?
Oh, God, I love Bob. I like, whether he likes or not, I feel like I've adopted him as a kind of grandfather in my life. And he, like, a few months ago, his family were just so bloody lovely, like, invited me down just for a fish pie to their house out in Oxford. So I just, like, on an afternoon, just got the train down to his place and he picked me up. And Bette Nielsen Chapman was down doing one of his Under the Apple Tree Yard sessions. And we all sat around and had fish pie and talked about country music. You know, listening to him talk about music and about what moves him in music, and like, and what incredible musicians and artists and writers and creators, what they don't take their talent for granted, and they don't take what they have to say for granted. And like, you go watch someone like Paul Simon and he's bloody levitating by the end of the gig because, you know, he's creating new worlds with his words and with his music, and each word and lyric and like line of a story has a poignancy and a point. And and Bob is such like an understanding of what that takes and where people have to go with that. And yeah, it was, you know, as well, I'm not like a singer, I'm not a country singer, so it was bloody terrifying. And you're like, Bob's in the house, guys. No, everybody stay calm. And I'm like having a bloody panic attack in the corner going, oh my God, he's going to find me out. Like, actually, the king of country is in the building and he's going to find me out.
Oh my God.
But he's been really, really lovely.
Your singing's incredible in the film. And was singing in a way your first love? Was that something that, was that where it all began for you, really? And then...
Yeah, I think it was actually. Like, music is such a massive part of my life. I don't think there's a day when I don't listen to music.
Uh-huh.
And I use it all the time in work. Like, I always make playlists of different kind of genres and composers whenever I'm like working on a script. And my mom's a harpist and a singer, and my dad is like, you know, self-taught musician and a poet, and music was always like around in our house, and kind of that way of expressing was something which was kind of respected and nurtured in our house. And I like, my youngest memory is listening to my mom sing and being in complete awe of like how she was moving, like she, and it, this would just be in her like town hall where she'd have like American students over the summer, and I'd be in the corner and seeing people's faces literally shift through the power of like her singing. And I think like music is magic like that, and it's not something that we communicate with each other every day with, you know, and yet we all universally find a dialogue with it, or like And it's not even in your head. It's like in your heart and your gut. And all of a sudden you're like in a corner crying your eyes out. Oh, God.
But that certainly seems to be the experience you have. I mean, having seen a couple of performances of yours now, that you do get into it. You know, it is something that seems to, it does seem to capture you.
Yeah, it does. Like, yeah. And it always takes me by surprise because I don't mean to. But I feel like I have to go into a certain place to tell the stories of these songs, you know. And I don't even know. It's not like I go in before the performance and go, okay, tonight I'm going to think about that and blah, blah, blah. I just, it takes me as well. Mm. And sometimes after, it's kind of a bit vulnerable. Like it's, it costs me.
Yeah,
but
okay.
It's also like I wanted to and I want to give it to people and I want to have that experience with music and I want to have that experience with scripts and I want to have that experience with characters where it takes something from out of me and gives me so much more.
So in many ways this role is the mother load. This film is the mother load in a way. This ticks all three boxes. In a way, which is cool.
Yeah, I'm fucked after this, to be honest. Like, Nicole Taylor has basically written me out of working for the next, like, rest of my life, basically. I don't know what I'm going to do after
this. No, I don't know. I've got a feeling she's written you into working for the next decade or so. But this is obviously really, really cool for you. And going back to the idea of music as well, how big a part of your life has been. So you mentioned jazz, or you growing up, you know, singing jazz in London, and you're not a huge country fan necessarily, or you probably are now. You could probably quote chapter and verse, but so what's the main calling for you? What's the
I have no idea.
If you had a Spotify, you know, thing, it was a genre, Jesse Buckley genre.
Well, all that's on my Spotify now is bloody country.
I know my just country western, just country.
No, yeah, exactly.
I nearly made that mistake.
You're taking the piss.
I know. There you go.
<Ba-dum-bum>. there's not one. Honestly, I love it all. Yeah, like at the moment I'm listening to Oliver Arnold's. I love listening to orchestras and I love listening to, I don't know. I'm like just found kind of Bob Dylan for the first time in my life. I always thought found him a bit whiny and now I'm like, oh my God, he's fucking brilliant. Like, guys, have you met this? He's really up and coming. I think he's going to be huge.
Because I have to ask you, I'll let you go in a second here, but there was a TV talent show in your past as well. I'd do anything. No, hang on a second here now. Because, you know, I think I know something of what I'm speaking about here as well, Jesse, because I once played Fagin.
Should
in
we
my
do
school
it?
Play. In my school play. But here's the thing. Fagin and Nancy don't have a song together, I don't think. So, therefore, we can't do it. We can't, you know, but what was that experience like for you?
We
could, but it would be, you know, it would be ripping it up. I wouldn't want to put anyone to shame. My Fagin was so bad, by the way. My mum taped it and used to play it back. She used to watch it in the wee.
You learn the best things from the worst things that you've done. Believe me, I've done a lot of bad things in my life. Anyway, we won't talk about that now.
In case somebody
tries and drags up the incriminating evidence. Do you know what? Like, I look back at that time and I can't. It feels like another life. Like. Mm. It was 11 years ago now, and I was 17, and I'd taken a year out of school because I wasn't very well, and I like just needed some time at home, and I ended up in London in that year and ended up on this show. And for me, I was so ignorant to the whole like rigmarole of it. Mm. Like for me, it was pure raw, like, oh my God, I'm getting to do what I thought would take 10 million years to even be part of. I think I was just like going from moment to moment, and I didn't really have an expectation of it. And I was really like lucky, you know, in lots of ways that for some reason people seemed to like me. As I flayed like some kind of crazed horse across the stage. Oh God. But I look back and I'm really proud of myself that I did that. Like, at that age, it's quite a big deal to put yourself in that position. And I think my ignorance was my saving grace, because it was just purely coming from love of singing and love of wanting to be part of this mad circus of a family that I still love, you know?
Yeah.
And there is a rawness there, which now I always want to find that. Like, there are so many people who sheen themselves up and become mechanical actors, or you've got to keep putting yourself out of your comfort zone. And I think I'd like look back at that 17-year-old Jessie and tell her, don't be so hard on yourself, but like, well done.
Yeah. Absolutely. Christ almighty, yeah. And I guess, us, you know, there's that weird thing, that kind of what if, because you came second in I Do Anything, but had you won, it may not have set you off in the path that brought you here. Not to this room. You wouldn't be sitting there going, man, I'm not doing the Empire podcast. My life is empty. But it brings you to Beast. It brings you to Wild Rose. It brings you to the stuff you're doing in the future.
Yeah. I mean, we've got no control over our life, really. Like,
yeah.
Who knows? Like, I could have done it and I could have ended up here. But
yeah.
I always say what's meant for you doesn't pass you by. And you just got to go into everything with as much dignity as you can. Try and learn something from it. Never expect anything. And just surprise yourself and everyone else around you.
Well, as Fagin once said, I'm reviewing the situation. I'm not going to do the voice. Dear God, I'm not going to do the voice.
Once we turn down the mics, we can have a dance.
That was even worse. My dancing was even worse.
Not as bad as mine. I don't think I'll be doing a film any time soon about a dancer. I can tell you that much for nothing.
Out of your comfort zone. Well, what's next for you? What's being thrown your way?
Really fun and terrifying things.
Can you elaborate?
I can't quite yet.
Ah, okay. Interesting. Well, next time, come back here. And maybe we'll bust out the old Nancy Fagin duet and see what happens.
Yeah.
Brilliant. Jessie Buckley, it's been a pleasure.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Thanks so much. Thank you.
Thanks.
So that was Jessie Buckley there. Absolutely fantastic. Really enjoyed that. And I really enjoyed also Wild Rose. But Helen here is going to tell us a little bit more about that.
Yes, so this is Jessie Buckley as Rosalyn Harlan. She's just been released from prison. She is moving back home. Her mum, who's played by Julie Walters, has been taking care of Rosalyn's two kids. But now, understandably, says, okay, you're back. It's your job to look after your children. And meanwhile, Rose herself is absolutely focused on trying to launch her career as a country singer. And that's basically the conflict of the film. She is so concerned with this dream that, you know, she doesn't want to kind of reconnect with these kids, and there's this sort of tension in her life between her family responsibilities and her, you know, her hopes and aspirations. Mm-hmm. And it's about her attempts, well, no, it's about her complete lack of attempt initially to resolve this conflict, but it's about her growing recognition that there is a conflict here and that she needs to figure out what she really wants out of her life. It's an astonishing story. It was written by Nicole Taylor, who, you know, grew up in Glasgow, went to the Grand Old Opry in Glasgow to listen to country music, you know, all the time, knows this kind of story really well. She also wrote the stunning Three Girls, if you saw that on TV last year. She's an amazing screenwriter. But she really gets into the heart of this character and the idea that, you know, it's not as simple as just following your dreams. It's not as easy as all these kind of pat phrases that we see on kind of Instagram pictures of sunsets. There is life to be dealt with as well. There are responsibilities to be sort of negotiated and considered. And it's not just as simple as, you know, I need to get to Nashville and then I'll be a star. There's other stuff going on in life. I mean, phenomenal performances from Jessie Buckley and Julie Walters, as you would expect. But I don't think there's really a false note in any of the actors in this film.
Yeah, they're all fantastic. This was the movie that I tweeted afterwards. There's a really good argument to be made, I think, that Julie Walters is the best actor on the planet.
That's fair. Yeah.
Because I was just sitting watching her going, Christ almighty, this woman's been doing this for 40 years now. Mm-hmm. She could do, as far as I can tell, any accent. She can do, as far as I can tell, any genre.
Mm-hmm.
She can do comedy. She can do drama. And the same person who does that incredible Mrs. Overall, spilling all the soup, bit of physical comedy in Victoria Wood, as seen on TV, can play a mother with real soul, real heart, and again, an impeccable
Scottish accent in this movie as well. I just think she's incredible. She's a bit of a national treasure. And I know she's a dame, but I feel somehow she's kind of underappreciated.
Yeah. She should be Damier. I mean, I don't know how we achieve that. Can we telegram the Queen again?
Can you double dame him? Can you do that?
Dame Julie Walters.
Dame Julie Walters. Why not?
It has a ring.
She can she can also sing Chiquitita by ABBA under a toilet stall door, which I don't think should be overlooked in these appraisals.
Who can't, Ben? Who can't?
She can teach Billy Elliot ballet. Come on.
Yeah, there's nothing she cannot do. Send her in against Thanos. He'll shit himself within seconds.
Also, a lovely little performance from Sophie Okonedo as Rose's sort of employer. Mm-hmm. She takes her on as a cleaning lady and then becomes kind of her champion. And it's just a really lovely little turn from her. It's kind of slightly insecure, not sure what she's doing, but very well-meaning and enthusiastic. It's really lovely.
Yeah, absolutely. But what I will say as well is, as well as thinking that Julie Walters may be the best damn actor on the planet, this movie, and we're only a couple of movies into Jessie Buckley's career, made me think that Jessie Buckley could become the best damn actor on the planet in the next few years if she continues on her current trajectory. Yeah, amazing in Beast.
Yeah.
Amazing in this.
Yeah.
She could sing. She could dance. She wants Batman's head in a lance. There's all sorts of stuff going on. She's just terrific.
Yeah. I haven't seen her be bad in anything. She was good in Tom Hardy TV show.
Taboo.
She was great in Taboo as well. So yeah, I mean, just props all round, basically, including director Tom Harper and my friend Johnny, who did a couple of days on focus pulling.
What?
Yeah.
Really?
I've got a friend who's a focus puller.
I actually thought the focus was a bit off in this
movie. How dare you? He was only there for 2 days.
Yeah, and there were a couple of shots that I thought were a little bit ropey. Out of focus, in fact.
Outrageous.
Lens cap was still on. So weird.
How dare you?
So we gave this, what did we give this?
We gave this 4 stars.
4 stars. We gave this 4 stars. 4 stars then for Wild Rose, and I am in agreement with that. Next up, Ben Travis will tell us all about the directorial debut of one Jonah Aloysius Hill. It is mid-90s.
It is. It's mid-90s, and it is a lovely, lovely coming-of-age story about a kid called Stevie, played by Sonny Suljic. I'm terrible with pronunciation. I'm sorry if that's wrong.
In fact, the pronunciation was not great.
It wasn't good, was it?
You were hoping I hadn't noticed. But I did.
Yep. But he was the kid in Killing of a Sacred Deer, if you were traumatized by that movie.
Oh, God.
he is having a better time than he was in Killing of a Sacred Deer, but he's still having some trouble. So he's about 12, 13 years old, living in LA. His older brother, played by Lucas Hedges, kind of constantly beats the shit out of him. And he's just in that like awkward stage. But he meets a group of skaters, and he starts hanging out with them, and they kind of take him in, and it's that kind of movie. It's that coming of age, finding your people, getting a new outlook on life, finding your tribe.
And this is very much inspired by Jonah Hill's childhood and adolescence, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so. It just feels very him generally in terms of the choices of the cultural references and the music. Oh my God, the soundtrack to this is incredible. Loads of like amazing 90s hip-hop stuff. The incredible Surf UK version of Wave of Mutilation by the Pixies. There's a scene where he's kind of got his board for the first time and he's trying out a few tricks and just constantly falling over. It's like a montage of him falling over and over again in front of the family house, set to this alternate version of a Pixies song. But as soon as that was happening, I was like, I'm so in on this. So it's amazing music, and it's just really, really well observed, especially for his Jonah Hill's debut film. It feels really confident. It's very stylistic. It's shot in that kind of boxed off ratio, very intentionally kind of lo-fi film stock, but also in the choices that it makes. There are so many scenes in this that just feel so real. So even though Stevie kind of gets 7 bells knocked out of him by his older brother, there's a scene at the start of the film where he sneaks into his brother's bedroom while he's away, and he's just kind of like rifling through the CDs and writing down notes of all the things that he should be listening to. It's this like shrine of things that are his kind of gateway into the world. But then also when he meets these skaters, he finds a sort of another way of life, and you start to see shifting perspectives on the characters.
Sounds a little like Sing Street in a weird way.
It is, except a lot meaner, because Sing Street was like, your brother can be the best person in the entire world.
Yes.
Whereas, in fact, as well, shout out to Lucas Hedges, because he's not actually in the film that much, but what he does in those scenes, at first you kind of hate him, he's this like horrible character, but then you start to see him in a different light, and he plays that incredibly. But also the thing that's great about this is the group of skate kids that Stevie meets, they affectionately name him Sunburn. They all have different nicknames. So you've got fourth grade and fuck shit who has that name because every single thing that happens, he starts a sentence with fuck shit, which sounds like it could be lame, but it feels really kind of real and naturalistic, which I think big props to Jonah Hill for that.
Is Big Props one of the characters?
Yeah, he's one of the other ones, actually. Okay. But all of those characters in the group are really nicely fleshed out, and you get the sense that for Stevie, this is like a world that he is visiting and being enriched by, but also won't be his entire life, whereas some of the other kids, it really plays into the sense of privilege that there's a character called Ray, who's the sort of leader of the group, and for him, like, skating is his life, it's his way out, it's his... They're all in kind of worse circumstances than Stevie, who's not from a massively well-off family, but they kind of they just about get by, whereas a lot of these kids have nothing, and skating is either their escape or it's the thing that they could do that's going to kind of get them some kind of career. And I think it plays that beautifully. I think the only thing is there's some kind of plot constructs towards the end that don't quite ring true, and I think that's because so much of the rest of it does. But the final 5 minutes of this film just put the biggest smile on my face, and I think it's probably my favourite thing I've seen this year so far. I love this film. I really love it. And if you love things like Linklater, if you love Dazed and Confused or Everybody Wants Some, I know a lot of people have compared this to Kids, the Larry Clark film. Mm. If you saw things like Skate Kitchen and Minding the Gap recently and you're liking that kind of skate-focused coming-of-age film, you absolutely go and see Mid-90s. I really love this film.
Rad, dude.
Awesome.
Yeah. Cowabunga, etc.
Gleam that cube and I'm out.
That's it.
Genuinely, that's it. Tony Hawk, he dragged a fridge around Ireland and then he did like a 720.
Quite.
Didn't he? No? Okay. All right. Four stars then. Four stars then for Mid-90s. Ben says it's the best film we've seen this year. Now, I would wager you would not be saying that had you seen Hellboy. The reboot, the latest version of Hellboy. Guillermo del Toro made two Hellboy films back in 2000 and... Wait a second.
Four?
2004? 2004?
Yeah. First one, 2004.
Yeah, and then Hellboy 2's 2008.
No.
Yep.
Yeah, the passage of time is a cruel mistress.
I wasn't said of both of those. Hell, man. Anyway, well, so there's a new Hellboy out.
Yeah.
And this is not directed by Guillermo del Toro, who obviously, there was some contentious circumstances and we weren't sure whether he was going to come back and do a Hellboy 3. And then he didn't. And now they have a new director, Neil Marshall, and a new Hellboy, David Harper, taking over for Ron Perlman. And Helen... You've seen this,
yeah.
We haven't, and there was only one screening of this movie, and it was on Wednesday morning.
Day before release.
Sometimes that's not a great sign, sometimes it's an okay sign. For example, Endgame's not going to screen too much before it comes out.
Sure.
Which is it?
No, it's the other kind, I'm afraid. This is not great. So we start in 5th century England, where King Arthur beheads the Blood Queen Nimue, played by Mila Jovovich, with some weird kind of like dubbed over voice thing. I don't know what's happening there, but it sounds odd. So she obviously gets chopped into bits, but still is alive. And when the bits get reassembled in the present day, well, David Harbour's Hellboy basically has to take her down somehow. The thing is, it's not a good film. The script needed at least one more pass, and let's be honest, probably two or three. I think David Harbour is great in the role, actually. I think he's really, really good. It's a different thing to what Ron Perlman did. He's a lot angrier. He's a bit hairier. There's a lot more cursing, obviously, because this is an R-rated film and they are desperate for you to know that it's R-rated. I mean, they literally say fucking in the first 30 seconds as a crow pecks out a dead eyeball of a corpse.
Right.
Like, they are so keen that you understand that it's super gory and violent now.
This ain't your parents, Hellboy kids.
Yeah, this is cool. I mean, just, like, get a grip.
Well, that's interesting, right? Mm. Because I don't remember there being that much swearing in the Mike Mignola comic books. Is there? Unless I just kind of glossed over it. I read a lot of Hellboy back in the day, but
I don't think of it being a huge part of it. Maybe it was more the sort of the violence and the ability to kind of go to the edge that way that they were worried about, and then the swearing is just a bonus. I don't know. But yeah, as good as Hellboy is, I feel like the problem here is he doesn't have that team around him to bounce off in the same way. Like, obviously he has Ian McShane as his sort of father figure, but Ian McShane is kind of, he's played this role a million times and it kind of shows at this point. And both of Hellboy's kind of sidekicks are sort of handicapped because Sasha Lane, who is so great when she's given room to work, is saddled with this English accent that seems to have consumed her this time. And, right. and all she seems to be focusing on is trying to get the accent right, which I'm afraid she doesn't. But also that then gives her nothing to work with. Her lines are the worst in the film. And maybe she could have delivered them better if she hadn't been worrying about the accent, or maybe they were just bad lines that no one could have saved. I'm not sure.
Okay.
Daniel Day-Kim is great, but he's so busy keeping a secret from us that we don't see why he's being so standoffish until super late in the day, which I think, again, kind of hampers your ability to really connect with him. There's a lot of little fan service nods here and there, but maybe just... it just doesn't really work. I think almost unforgivably for an English director, and Neil Marshall can be great when he has the material to work with, but this does that thing that American films do, where there are only two types of people in England and in the UK. There are the super rich people and there are the Cockneys. So it's basically stately home or council estate and nothing in between. And I just find that incredibly irritating. And so that didn't make me warm to it either. So.
Talking of warming to it, because I haven't seen this yet, but in the run-up to it, I rewatched both of the Del Toro films, which I have a lot of affection for, and they have their kind of horrific moments. I think I'd forgotten how intense the Tooth Fairy sequence is in Hellboy 2, where they're kind of literally like pulling people's eyes and grabbing teeth out of people's faces and stuff, in a 12A and everything.
No F-bombs, though.
No F-bombs. Yeah. But they are charming. They are warm, charming films, and...
My favorite
scene in Hellboy 2 is when Hellboy and Abe Sapien get drunk and sing Barry Manilow. It's such a lovely moment.
Yeah.
And it has that tenderness to it. And it seems from the trailers and things that this is lacking that.
Yeah, I would say that's true. I mean, Hellboy gets drunk, but he gets drunk on his own and he's an angry drunk, for example. I mean, there is, I think, something that must be a deliberate nod to Del Toro, which is that we start in Tijuana with a sort of Mexican wrestling match. And that feels like a deliberate sort of homage of some sort. But I was bored, and I shouldn't be bored in a film like this.
That's a shame, because I had seen some footage of this. And I thought actually it was encouraging and promising and showed... because the Del Toro films are great. They didn't do huge box office, which is why obviously there wasn't a Hellboy 3. But in the one for them, one for me dichotomy of a person's career... the Hellboy films don't really fit into that neatly for Del Toro, because they are both one for them and one for him.
He loves monsters.
And
it comes across in every frame.
They're so meticulously designed and beautifully lit and well acted. Ron Perlman's fantastic. And there's such a real affection for those films that I was hoping that this film might in some way might match them. But it's a real shame. I hope I'll be able to see it this weekend. But... very, very sad to hear that. Two stars then for Hellboy. And then very, very quickly in Dispatches, we should also mention two other films, Little and The Man Who Killed Hitler, and then The Bigfoot, which gives Sam Elliott a long overdue lead role.
Yes, it does. And so just to take the latter quickly, from that name, you might be expecting a sort of, you know, exploitation.
Bubba Hotep.
Sort of monster movie, essentially. And it's really a very somber character piece about a guy who did violent things during the war and was extremely good at them, but has never really learned how to kind of reintegrate into society, and who lost a lot doing that and has never come to terms with that loss. And he's now a loner, and he's kind of embittered, and he's just very separated from people, and he's hurting, he's traumatized. And then he's called back into action to face this new threat, this Sasquatch, which threatens to unleash a plague on humanity. So the title is technically accurate, but entirely misleading at the same time, basically. Sam Elliott's great. The film is a little bit patchy around him. Aidan Turner plays his younger self, and does an okay job. He doesn't do an impression, but he tries to get a little bit of a Sam Elliott flavour.
Does he have a big tash?
No, he doesn't. I think just because there's only one of those tashes, you can't really mess with
that.
Does
a tash get a backstory? Like, why would you grow a tash like that? Why would you not have a tash like that and then grow a tash like that? Why would you not
have
just
you
start
not
off
seen
with a tash?
That? Oh, yeah. Well, maybe he didn't know that how glorious the moustache would be. I think there's something to it. Anyway, so yeah, it's an interesting film rather than a must-see, but if you like Sam Elliott, it's got a lot of Sam Elliott for you. And then Little is a film that was pitched by Marcy Martin from Black-ish. I think when she was 10, and she becomes the youngest credited producer, I believe, in Hollywood history, which is astonishing. And she is fantastic in this. So this is basically Regina Hall plays Jordan, who is this tech company owner, and she gets transformed into her 13-year-old self, who's played by Marsai Martin. They're both great. Issa Rae, who plays the put-upon assistant, who becomes the sort of mentor figure and kind of friend to the younger Jordan, is also fantastic. I have nothing against the leads at all. I just find this a little bit uneven in its comedy and definitely too long. It's the guts of 2 hours. And if it was about a half hour shorter, I think it would be significantly funnier for me.
Isn't it weird how we're seeing two sort of riffs on Big in cinemas within 2 weeks of each other between Little and Shazam? It's both Big if superhero and Big if the opposite.
Yeah.
Weird.
And Bigfoot and then Hitler.
Whoa.
Whatever it is. No, that's the other way. No, I got it wrong. Anyway.
And Big Red.
Oh my God. What was the other film out this week?
The mid-90s.
Wild Rose.
Big Star. Big Voice.
Yeah.
Big everything. Great. Well done, everybody. Three stars for Little. Fantastic. And that is it. That's it for this week's Empire podcast. Join us, but not me. Crucially, I cannot stress that enough. Next week for more film-related fun. When I say we, I mean me. You and maybe you.
Maybe me.
But definitely not me. We'll be joined by Andrew Scott.
Ooh.
Star of Steel Country. And Neil Jordan.
Ooh.
Co-writer and director of Greta. Both Irish.
Yeah.
Big fact.
Taken over.
Yeah, absolutely. But yes, until then, until that auspicious occasion, until we meet again, it is goodbye from Ben Travis.
Cowabunga, dudes.
What?
I don't know.
I enjoy your sign-offs, Ben.
Thanks.
It keeps me alive. There are three things keep me alive at the moment.
What are the other two? Do I want to know?
Well, you can guess.
I mean, one of them is the...
Endgame.
Endgame, and the other is the new Pope picks?
No. No? Football. Okay, there are four. There are four things keep me alive. It is goodbye from Helen O'Hara.
Toodaloo.
And it's goodbye from me. I am, as I said, off down the beach tomorrow, 2 p.m, tighty whities, nips out, the whole kit and caboodle. Follow me on my Instagram, Snapchat, slide into my DMs for more information, but basically 2 p.m, beach round the back of Asta. See you then. Thanks for listening. See you in 3 weeks. Bye.